people who are barely tech literate will have all the nicest technology in their house, and extremely tech literate people will have a printer and a shotgun to shoot the printer if it messes up. I forget whose quote that was. I might have heard Edward Snowden say it or something.
Well, I looked at the Linux that he used. It was called Tails, and it would kind of automatically wipe your system after every boot. Mm-hmm. But it was not like he was really hiding anything. He just uploaded it and fled to Russia.
Yeah.
So you could have done that on a Windows PC, but. Did you ever hear about that guy who was like he worked at like fast food for a while, and then he got a job in the NSA, and he leaked a whole bunch of stuff about drones, I think.
No.
Yeah. It wasn't like, I think it was just like about drone strikes on civilians, so it wasn't anything you didn't already know, but.
I always think it's crazy when somebody leaks, like, hey, the government is creating, or the government is actively participating in creating atrocities. And they're like, he sold out the military. He's a bad guy. And you're like, not really.
I was thinking similar about that today, because that friend I was talking to who became, well, I don't know if he's gay or not, but he was upset that I didn't like gay priests, and he got kicked out of seminary, yada, yada, yada. But
yeah.
I was thinking, I was just like, well, you know, the guy who told me he was gay, I did mention his name by name, and at the time he said don't tell anybody because it was part of a mandatory psychology meeting I had to go to. But if he had told me he's a pedophile and I didn't say anything, which he pretty much did, the church would be like, hey, why didn't you point out that this guy's a pedophile?
Yeah. So what's the point where it's like, hey, this is really, you know.
If you tell me secretly that you're going to go murder somebody, do you just not tell the guy? Because, oh, he told me secretly. It's not like I'm your confessor.
Well, I remember. I mean, on one hand, it's kind of like I was always taught not to snitch because nobody likes snitches.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, you've got, like, I know kids who are like, yeah, if somebody told me don't come to school tomorrow, I would just be like, yeah, cool, and then pretend I was sick and let the school get shot up because that guy was cool to me. Like, I had a guy, like, go through his whole, like, talk that he was like, yeah, if the quiet kid comes to me and he says I'm going to shoot up the school, I knew I was the chosen one. So I'm just not going to tell anybody. You go home. You don't want him mad at you.
Well... Yeah, that's a little different because it's not like they would do anything if you told anybody.
They might. Like, they might be like, hey,
that 6-year-old kid who shot that teacher just a couple months ago was warned like two people the same day, and they didn't do anything.
You say a 6-year-old kid?
Yeah, there was a 6-year-old kid shot some teacher in the Northeast, I think.
Did the teacher die?
No, she lived.
Huh, that's interesting. I have the coolest BB gun.
But like, he had told people, and he had threatened to kill people. Like, I think he had threatened to kill the teacher before. And she had brought it to other people's attention, and nobody cared.
They're just like, yeah, you get over it.
It's well, a 6-year-old.
acquaintances that I have is teaching at a pretty rough school. And today they caught a kid with a gun, and he ran out of the school, threw the gun up on the roof of the school, and then tried to walk back in like nothing happened.
Yeah.
he was like, no, I didn't have a gun. I didn't have a gun anywhere. But they could like just see that he threw it on the roof. And so they put the whole school in lockdown. And it's like the 5th or 6th time the school's been in lockdown recently. Because they had a shooting in the parking lot. They keep catching kids with guns. But the other hand, the kids are coming with guns because it's such a violent area.
Yeah.
And, like, some of them are coming to show off, and some of them I bet are getting them because it's like, hey, my bully has a gun.
Yeah.
And my parents...
That's kind of how it was with pocket knives at the school I went to. Like,
you think you're... Yeah. How crazy it is that we send our kids off, and this is coming from a homeschooled person, that we send our kids off before, you know, puberty even, and you're like, all right, you got to fend for yourself with all these other people without the help of your parents or your family for the next 12 years or what. You know, it's just...
Yeah. I saw a video today. I didn't watch the video, but I saw somebody commenting. It was this 15-year-old kid walked up to this 9-year-old girl on a... I think it was a school bus, and just beat her mercilessly. Just completely.
Yeah, and there was, like, a smaller one that jumped in.
I didn't watch the whole video.
It was like a little girl, and this bigger kid came and beat the crap out of her, and then a smaller kid jumped in and got a couple licks in, too.
Yeah. Right.
If it's the same video.
Well, might happen all the time. I don't know.
Yeah.
I never liked the school bus.
There's some savages out there.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's just leaving your kids completely unprotected like that. Just like, good luck. And if you've got the good kids, they're not going to be the ones with knives and guns at school when people start, you know.
Yeah. Well, and if they... There was a guy I read about today who had killed an illegal immigrant in Arizona, the Arizona-Mexico border. He had killed some citizen of Mexico, they say, and he was just in jail with a $1 million bond. So,
why?
Well.
Why?
You why? Kill an invader and you get a $1 million bond, and if you take your shirt off and shoot somebody with a shotgun, it's... Cool.
But did he shoot somebody just coming over the border? Or was
I didn't
he
read
attacked?
The whole story.
Oh, that's my kind of journalism.
Yeah.
I read the first three lines. I got bored. I shut the article.
Look, I was busy watching the Grammys play. Did you see that Unholy, Sam Smith?
No. No, I tend not to watch Sam Smith. Isn't he the one that kisses boys and stuff?
Yeah. I just saw that Pfizer sponsored... I think it was him. It might have just been the Grammys, but in it he sang "Unholy" and dressed up like a demon.
While sponsored by Pfizer.
Yep.
The dead baby vaccine.
Yep. There you go.
Isn't that cool? Isn't that just neat? Oh, then there was that whole Project Veritas thing where that's where I did your style of journalism just now. Where I didn't quite watch all of it. I don't understand what happened, but they had that guy go on a gay date, and he claimed that they were, like, working on new strains so that they could continue putting out new vaccines and keep the whole, you know, money train rolling.
Did you see any of that? I did watch that video. But the way I understood it wasn't as groundbreaking as Project Veritas makes it sound. Like, because I thought he was just, like, researching... modifying the virus to make a vaccine. It's kind of what he said. And that's how you make a vaccine. You take a virus and you weaken it.
Yeah. So, well, it seemed to me that they were, like, also studying, like, releasing the modified virus or something. I don't know. I have to look into it.
I saw one where China was studying hot air balloons. And if they can keep biological agents alive under the guise of, can a meteorite come in from... outer space and still have some alien on it.
And then they sent a hot air balloon to see how far across the United States they could get.
Yeah.
Or a weather balloon.
Yeah.
That's wild.
And we shoot it down with a million-dollar missile.
I love how those Project Veritas videos basically start out where they're like, you're not Project Veritas, are you? And they're like, no, we're definitely not. Okay, we eat the babies. It's like, there's so many horrific... You're not Project Veritas, are you? We're building a bunker underneath Washington D.C. And right there, it's crazy the stuff that how they even get into those circles and infiltrate them is insane. And the fact that it's pure evil, and every time they show it, it's like everybody acts like Project Veritas is evil.
Yeah. It reminds me a lot of how Russia stole all of our military secrets during the Cold War.
Mm-hmm.
And you're like, how did the Russians find somebody? Well, they got money. If you got money, you can find somebody. So.
Yeah. Well, you can train somebody.
What was it that Fidel Castro said? He had 11 guys he trusted?
Yeah, and he wished he had less, I think. Did he say he started the revolution with like a couple hundred people or so, something, but he wished he'd started it with even less people?
I don't know.
I don't know the quote off the top of my head, but basically it was like, I started with almost nobody, and I wish I'd started with even less.
I'm not a big Che fan.
No. Yeah. I'm thinking of Fidel, but Che was
his buddy.
Did Che help out there?
Yeah. Yeah.
But Che died in South America.
Yeah, he did, didn't he?
Yeah. Which Che was interesting. Che, they like were like, Che Guevara was the best man ever. Also, he liked murdering gay people. And I was like, that seems like he would go against all your guys' stuff. But I guess his communism overruled his anti-LGBT zealotry.
Yeah, well,
in their minds. They're like, yeah, but he had a cool motorcycle and he was hot.
Yeah. Do you know China's stance on gay people? Because I'm not really sure, 100%.
I watched, there was a Chinese billionaire that put out this thing that he would give, like, this huge sum of money to whoever married his daughter. And, like, all these men submitted to it. But, the thing was his daughter is married to a woman, and he just isn't happy about it. So, yeah. He put this huge bounty on any man that could seduce his daughter and have a family.
All right.
But so I don't know. It might be somewhat tolerated. I don't know if they have gay marriage, but I actually don't know that.
Yeah, it's something to look up.
I saw some Eastern European country just allowed abortion and gay marriage recently, like in the last couple of weeks.
Was it Turkey?
It's one of those. It was like Estonia or Latvia. It's one of those small ones that you forget about.
Yeah. Well, I would have thought they would have done it before, earlier.
Well, there's one country, and this is all, like, this whole little section is just me pulling stuff out of the back of my mind. There's one country where there was I don't know if he was the king or the duke or whatever he is, but he for the first time in, like, 50 or 100 years or something, used the king power to block allowing abortion in the country. And I had meant to go back and see if it was the same country, but I haven't. I just heard about both of those things in passing.
Yeah. Yeah, that was what I was hoping Bolsonaro would have done.
Yeah, Bolsonaro. I wonder what if he was just like, okay, I'm definitely going to die if I stay here, or if it was kind of just a fear run, or if he thought he actually lost, or what, you know, what put him into that position.
Yeah, I don't know. Brazil's an interesting country. All right, well, you want to get into Tel El Hamam?
So, I saw in 1990, Belgium suspended a king for refusal to endorse abortion law. But that's not what I'm thinking of. Sure, yeah, we can get into it.
All right, so what we were going to talk about on this podcast is a city in the Jordan Valley area called Tel El Hamam. It's an archaeological dig. And what's interesting about it is because it fits a lot of the characteristics of Sodom or Gomorrah or one of those four or five cities that got destroyed when God rained fire and brimstone on them. And you're like, how do you know that? Well, because it had molten pottery and shocked quartz. And those two things can't exist from any man-made disaster like war or a volcano or anything like that. And I'll show some pictures of some of the photos they have from the dig, because it's kind of like when Mount Vesuvius erupted. They have some people that are like posed in their last moments, which is pretty horrifying, thinking that, hey, it's located on the Dead Sea, right where the Bible says Sodom and Gomorrah were located. And it got obliterated in a very short time period. There's a very thin layer of ash and molten mud bricks and molten pottery. And all of it just got destroyed, and nobody lived there for hundreds of years afterwards. Which is pretty unusual, considering that it was one of the largest metropolitan areas in the region.
It's interesting that even people who discount the theory that it could be, you know, Sodom and Gomorrah, are still like, yeah, it was probably just like a really big air burst that melted everything.
Yeah.
I don't know if you've read into any of the outside.
Wikipedia is really funny when it tries to disprove God by saying stupid things. And they're like, well, these guys are trying to say that it's just a meteorite that came down and pretty much made a nuclear bomb, and it wasn't God, but it was a meteorite.
Well, and it's not just Wikipedia. There are people who have basically dedicated their lives to trying to prove that it was just like a big airburst. It's really interesting. And there is some credit to say that maybe that's what it was, but also fire and brimstone from the heavens. God could just use a meteor.
Yeah.
God often works through the world, and if there was this specific reason that it would have been destroyed, that doesn't discount the fact that it is biblically accurate.
Yeah. It reminds me of St. Bridget talks in one of her books about how this Cyprus is going to be destroyed, and then it's destroyed, and it's ruined utterly. And that's pretty much what happened to this place. And what's really weird is that they found salt in that layer. How are you going to find salt from salt and molten pottery? Go in your backyard and try and melt a terracotta pot. Go for it.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to need something very industrial to be able to pull it off.
Yeah. Yeah, you're definitely not doing that just a normal fire.
Yeah.
And not to that scale either. There's no way to just heat something that big that quickly and to be able to get that kind of melting pattern. I've actually delved into pottery myself, and it is insane, especially when you get to, like, your glassing and stuff like that, where how hot it has to be, how long, like, how intense that heat has to be and how concentrated it has to be to make something happen.
Yeah.
Whereas you'd think that you could just melt stuff down in a good fire, and it might deform a glass bottle, but you don't get anything like, you know.
Yeah, I remember trying to melt soda cans in a normal fire. You can't even melt aluminum without.
Yeah. Well, I've done it, but it has to be in the very middle, and it's hot, and you lose the aluminum because it's. But on this huge scale, it's not something that you could just make happen. I guess is the point I was trying to make there.
Yeah, kind of like a bunch of molten steel and kerosene.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's a whole other topic.
I have seen in house fires molten brass, so
yeah.
They can get a lot hotter than just a normal campfire, but...
Well, I also have seen disfigured steel. It's not going to melt, but it will bend.
It sags, yeah.
And if you've got airflow coming up from the bottom... I don't think that, like, you would need necessarily jet fuel to melt steel beams if you've got a hot enough fire racing through, and it just kind of causes a natural
If you can preheat the oxygen coming in, then you could melt it. But you can't melt it without preheated oxygen.
But the thing is, we're getting off topic here, but I don't feel like that's the big part of what that is. The big part is, did we know it was going to happen, and what steps were taken to get rid of it, and were there economic reasons to push for this event that killed Americans? And that's where the question should be asked. A lot of people get stuck in the details.
Yeah. I mean, it's kind of suspicious when they announced the tower fell before it fell, but...
Yeah. Well, is it Tower 9? That's just such a crazy, like, offhanded coincidence that would... You know, you have a building fall over here, so another one collapses.
Yeah. That was Tower
7. It is technically possible. Sorry, Tower 7. It's technically possible, but it's not, like, very likely.
Yeah. Well, looking at some of these buildings falling in Turkey right now. You see very similar collapse, but they're completely different. Engineering. They're concrete structures that are made with low quality concrete and small amounts of rebar, and they're just crumbling the same way the Twin Towers did. And
but they're also being hit with charges, aren't they?
The earthquake. I saw a video that lasted a minute and a half, which is just
We were talking about the earthquake. Okay,
yeah,
I
in Turkey.
Now.
Yeah, it's a minute.
For some reason, I was thinking of a video I recently saw about Syria and buildings collapsing in Syria.
Yeah. Buildings collapse. It's like the whole Tower of Babel.
Well, I guess some places in the U.S. had frost shakes that were registered from, like, the ground freezing so hard, the last two big freezes we've had through.
Oh, yeah.
Where we almost got deep frost, and then it thawed out again, and the ground kind of shook in small spots. Huh. But nothing like we had in Turkey.
Yeah, I never heard of that. Well, back to Sodom.
Mm-hmm.
We can discuss what the people were doing that led them to that. And obviously, it says it in the Bible. There were men doing things with men. And mm-hmm. and it wasn't necessarily uncommon for that area, because I remember in the Epic of Gilgamesh, they talk about similar kind of themes, although they seem a little bit more innuendo than mm-hmm. quite that descriptive. But
well, yeah, it's such a shocking thing. Like, especially as a little kid, you're like reading through the Bible, and you get to this verse where a guy is trying to protect God's messengers by giving out his own daughters, and they're still like, no, we don't want your.
Yeah,
we don't want your daughters. We want those men that you have in there, those holy men, who turn out to be angels.
Yeah.
And, like, I could see, it's just as a Catholic, and I could see why God would just be like, no, okay, I'm bombing this whole place. No more.
All right, and then Abraham asks him, like, well, what if there's only 10 good people? You're going to destroy the whole, you know, those 10 good people with the whole city? And there weren't even 10 good people. And I find myself looking around and asking myself the same question. Are there even 10 good people in, name a city in the U.S.?
Mm-hmm.
Because if there were, what are they doing to stop any of it?
Well, I thought that was, this is a little off topic, but when you look around, like, I go to a gym that is supposed to be this Christian gym, and it's like, they'll have all this stuff on the walls, like, lift yourself up for Jesus and all this stuff. And I walk in, and I get on the shoulder press machine, and I'm sitting there, and I'm working through my set, and all of a sudden, the music switches, and it is literally sex noises, and it's sex noises that leads into a rap about sodomizing women and killing people. And then the next song is about, I don't even remember. I was still trying to block it out. But me and one lady were the only people in the gym that were like, hey, this is probably not good. And the rest of the gym's like, oh, it's workout music. We got to get pumped up. And I was thinking, like, I'm supposed to be in this Christian gym. And, you know, I know myself to be a sinful person at times. And then I see all these people who are like flauntly, oh, the second one was outright saying the guy said he was better than Jesus. And he said that he was a young gorilla something. I was all over the place. It seemed like there was two raps in one, and then that he was a god, and that I don't know. But it was just like, okay, well, this is supposed to be the best place in town. This is supposed to be the Christian spot. And it is a very good gym run by a very good guy, but he wasn't there. There was no patrol over the music, and the whole place just went out into bit like this just horrific stuff.
Yeah, I mean, that's something a lot of people take for granted, is just how indecent music can actually be and how it can affect people. Even when you think, oh, it's just words, sticks and stones can break my bones, but words will never hurt me. But yeah, they will. If you're going to expose yourself to these things, you're going to have it come back to haunt you.
I also think that people they don't realize the things that they're so indoctrinated into thinking are okay because it's a part of the culture are sinful. So you get used to something, and whether it's, we've talked like bad movies that have, you know, horrific scenes, or advertising that leads you into lust and temptation or anger or slovenliness, and you just get to these things, and or men and women dressing immodestly, you become normalized to them, and then you have a hard time realizing that what is your normal is sinful. And I think that you can just keep growing on that until the next thing you do is like trying to rape angels, you know,
Overton window.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, just keep shifting and shifting and shifting until the normal is so far over there that it's not even reachable.
Yeah, it's like what you told me yesterday. Is like all these ideas that we're saying might seem strange to people, but we're just like the average person in the 1950s.
Yeah, yeah. Probably even less than the average person in the 1950s.
I don't know. I hope to be that conservative.
Well, if you go to the right times, because we might be very conservative in the right part of Greece, you know.
yeah. But in the 1950s, if you had drag shows for little kids, somebody would get something coming to them.
Yeah. But you can read, I've read, you know, talks of, like, evangelical preachers at that time, or whatever you want to say, like, the tent preachers, who are still kind of, that was kind of dying out at the time, but they were talking about that, like, the teeny boppers and the drive-ins where everybody was fornicating and running around in cars and picking girls up without any kind of, like, parental supervision or morals. And, like, that stuff was starting to purvey and become normal in the culture. And you can see it through the music and everything else. It had become so normalized that, like, it was the music getting played on the radio that everyone listened to. And so, and then you from that point to now, have this slow build. And it is a slow, gradual build. There's people alive that remember that. But it's such a slow, year by year, it's just only a couple people go, whoa! Yeah. And then next thing you know,
Who was it that you said was complaining about getting streetlights?
Oh, the Catholic Church at one point said that they warned that streetlights would lead to sinfulness because people would be up and about and you wouldn't be home with your wife. You might stay up later and be out when the vagrants are out, and it would stop. It would keep people out past their working hours because they could navigate the street. And they weren't wrong. Does technology coming forward always has good and bad? I think that's like the further we move forward, the greater the chasm between like the extreme good and extreme bad gets. So every time we have more power, to do good or evil. Mm-hmm. And so I don't think that streetlights are inherently bad, but I think that they can push people into doing bad things, and it becomes easier and to be in sin.
Yeah. Well, and one thing a priest would always stress with me is, like, when you're in a routine, it's easier to be good because you can keep out all the temptations of novelty, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
And you have the structure of your prayer and everything. And when you lose your routine, then all these things can fall apart.
Yeah, no, and it's really hard to keep a routine with today's cycle and how everybody has gotten. One of the things I noticed in college is that everything every year got later and later to the point where it's like, okay, we're having such and such meeting at 9:30 tonight, and then it would be over at 11. Yeah. But then I was an agriculture student, so I'd have to still be at class at 7. But a lot of these students that I knew were starting to schedule all their classes at 11, 12, and not waking up until, you know, midday, just because everything had shifted to this. And I don't think that's good for you. I think that there is something to that where the church is like, hey, bad things are going to happen. That's probably, it's not the worst thing, but it's probably led to some bad things.
Yeah, it seems natural for man to be about his work during the day and then to sleep at night. And
I wonder what the natural progression was in Sodom and Gomorrah. Like, how long did it take them? Was this a gathering of people that came together? Like your San Francisco's where everybody from the country decides to go there, or like there's basically a town in every state where people will to like a certain devious act will come together to participate in it. So I wonder, was Sodom one of those like migratory like pilgrimage places for sin? Or is it some place that kind of like the whole of our society just slowly started to seep into these ingrained acts?
It wasn't just Sodom, though, because it was Gomorrah, and I believe there were three other towns, but only four of them got destroyed because Lot wanted to flee to the fifth one, and God spared it. And then Lot went there, and he saw the destruction, and he's like, I'm moving to the woods like God told me to.
Back to the Benedictine option.
Yeah, like, I was like, go into the hillside, I'm going to destroy everything. And he's like, I'm going to die if I go into the hillside. Can I go to that city? And he goes there, and then he sees the destruction, and he's like, I don't feel safe here anymore. Which is probably a good thing, because
say destruction, I am forgetting this story. I should have read it again. Was it that it was, like, partially destroyed, or it was just the evil in the city?
All the cities were burnt to the ground.
So did they find a little pile of salt where Lot's wife was?
I think there's like a salt pillar next to the Dead Sea that they call Lot's wife.
Really?
But I don't think it's Lot's wife.
It's like 400 feet tall.
It's pretty big. I think it's bigger than a normal person.
She was a very big lady. But no, so what have you found in your research, I guess, from the scientific perspective?
From the scientific perspective of the destruction?
Just in, like, carbon dating, what they've been pushing, what you think kind of proves that this might be Sodom and Gomorrah.
From the carbon dating, they come up with a year that's slightly different than the year of Abraham, but it's off by, like, 300 years, and carbon dating, in my opinion, isn't actually that accurate because it's all just speculation. And we're counting what's left, and we're hoping that nothing changed in the meantime. And it doesn't... You look at the amount of contamination you can get, and you can be off by a certain amount. Like, they give you a probability, where if this percent certain that it happened between here and here. Well, if you were off by 300 years, you would have been at the time Abraham saw it happen. So, but that's the other thing. I don't even know when Abraham was.
I saw a fossil not, like... Well, I say not long ago. I was still in school. And they had a gap window of like 3,000 years that it could be from. They said it was radiocarbon dated to, I forget when, but it literally had a gap of 3,000 years. So
it wasn't an actual fossil. It was just a preserved thing.
Yeah, it was something. But they said that they radiocarbon dated it.
Well, you can't radiocarbon date a rock.
I guess so. Carbon dated. Carbon date, because radiocarbon date doesn't really work.
It's the same thing.
In that context. Okay.
So.
I'm way off then. But I just remember walking into a museum, seeing it, and they were like, oh yeah, it's between this time period, and we radiocarbon dated it to that, and that's what we think it is. And it may have been, I think it was fish that had been, like, preserved in something. Where it was actually like a scale or something.
Amber, something like that.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't remember exactly what it was. Because there's a bunch. It was a huge exhibit, and I ran through it. But I just remember seeing that thing about carbon dating. I was like, that is so far off.
Yeah.
I'll try to look it up later and see what it was.
If you look at the Shroud of Turin, their best argument is that the radiocarbon dating didn't check out. Because it said that they think it was the 1300s. And Jesus wasn't born in the 1300s. And that's such a lousy argument for a piece of fabric that's been restored over the years, and because we can see that it has been restored, and it's collected pollen from everywhere. So every time you put pollen dust on it, you're giving it a little bit of new life. And because you've looked at the pollen grains, and it's traveled all over Europe and from Jerusalem even. And so they're like, well, the radiocarbon dating doesn't match. And the Shroud of Turin, I believe, is legitimate.
I remember seeing the, oh, it doesn't radiocarbon date, and just kind of thinking to myself, well, my belief in God doesn't really rest on the Shroud of Turin, but I also have no reason to believe it's false at this point because I didn't feel the evidence was strong enough.
Yeah. Well, their other argument is, like, his legs are, like, slightly different lengths, and they're like, surely he couldn't have slightly different... He was hanging on a cross for his last hours. You think his legs couldn't have gotten disjointed?
Didn't they break? Well, no, they didn't break his... They didn't break his legs, but in general, they usually broke people's legs.
Yeah, and that's where the myth got started, where they said he couldn't have had his nails through his hands because it would rip out. That's completely untrue. It was based on a study where they assumed that the feet gave no support.
Mm-hmm.
And even on that study, they concluded that his hands could hold a 180-pound man, which the Shroud of Turin, they estimate at 200 pounds. So if his feet could hold 20 pounds...
I worked at a slaughterhouse, and you did have to put stuff through ligaments, but I figure I've never put a hook through or anything through it, like a hand. But there'd be something there to hold. You know, if you go between
as far as I know, there was a study done by a guy who found a gangrenous arm that he got permission to take and test, and he put a nail through it, and it held 80 pounds.
And that's what he's basing everything off of.
And that's how they're like, well, they must have tied him.
Yeah. I remember for the longest time, like, everybody at my church would say that like, oh, yeah, he was nailed through here. We now know. And, like, all these old people were saying, we now know that all our statues are wrong.
Well, and the Jehovah's Witness are like, well, he was nailed on a torture stake because the Greek word resembles the word for stake in English.
I don't really take much the Jehovah's Witness say to heart, generally. I've met a couple that were good people, but it's wild.
They have a point that Roman execution wasn't typically in the form of a cross, but Jesus' execution wasn't typical. So,
yeah,
you can't just say statistically he would have had short hair. I saw that too. Statistically, Jesus would have had short hair because the men of that time had short hair. Yeah, well, you remember Samson? He had long hair. Mm-hmm. There was a point.
The Catholic Church has always had the whole Nazarite thing, too, where if you're doing a specific thing, you get a special dispensation to especially have long hair.
Yeah.
Like the Nazarite vows and stuff. But there was also, I've always found it interesting, like, they'll say, oh, well, this is what he would have looked like. And they'll just take, like, a montage of what people in the current Middle East look like. Put them into, like, a random image generator. Nobody talks about the fact that, like, Africa has been colonized from, like, that part of, from Africa and all these different areas have colonized back and forth to each other so many times that the genetics down there are completely different than they would have been 2,000 years ago.
Yeah, taking a random Muslim from Jerusalem is not really fair.
Yeah. Well, it's like all the mummies that they keep pulling out have red hair and pale skin. And they're like, oh, and we also don't talk about the huge changes in the geography down there. And
they really had red hair.
Plant life. And what, yeah, yeah, a bunch of the mummies have red hair.
Oh, I thought that was just Irish.
But no, I think Cleopatra even has
red hair. You heard it here first. Mummies are Irish.
Well, you got to think that the Greeks went to the Greeks went and knew of the Egyptians. The Romans pushed in, and you had actually like Mark Antony and all that in Egypt.
Yeah.
So you have this European influence in Egypt, but you also see like the older the mummies are, the less influence they have, and it makes sense. It makes sense that not only would people from the south be pushing up into these areas, but also that people with darker skin complexions would survive better in these areas as well. And so you see an attack towards darker skin complexions, which is completely fine. I like the whole, we need to figure out Jesus's race is one of the dumbest things ever. And it's even dumber when you're like, I have to prove that he's the race I want him to be.
He must be black because I said so.
He must be black or he must be white. It's like he was a guy in Israel, you know, over 2,000 years ago. That whole genetic makeup and race of people doesn't exist in the same way that it did back then. So there's no way to prove exactly what he was, other than just by trying to like rebuild from whatever we have left over from there and see what we think the genetics would have been.
Yeah.
It's just that in Syria, there are native Syrians who have like blue eyes and blonde hair, and they just randomly pop up because the original Syrians were very light-complected, and then just over the tons and tons of being colonialized from the south and invasions from the north and back and forth, you have this very diverse population of genetic changes. And so to say that somebody in this area of huge change and so much, I mean, they were occupied by the Romans while he was alive, right?
Yep.
So you had this huge occupational force of the Romans who weren't the first people by any means to invade Israel, and we say, oh yeah, well he was definitely this because the current people who have had so much different change throughout that time in one of the most unstable areas of the world when it comes to race and culture and everything else, he for sure looks like this because we made a computer study. It enrages me. Rant over. I'm sorry, I just took
over. There might be a reason they call it the Middle East.
you see, like, oh, I forget what the dictator said. That one of the ones that we took out was like, I'm the only thing holding back like the colonialization of Europe, and if you take me out, you'll regret it. And say what you will about it, but after we took him out, we had this huge unstopped migrant crisis all throughout Europe and America, and not only that, huge destabilization because of the loss of these leaders or dictators that we destabilized for our own.
It's also right up there with the Well, all those Europeans and their slave trade, when if you look at the grand scheme of human history, Europeans had such a little part of the slave trade that has existed in Africa and in the Middle East. And heck, the word slave comes from a people called the Slavs.
You also look at the fact that not only do you have a lot of popes and stuff that were like pretty anti-slavery throughout history, they would tell, you know, if you are a slave, do your best to serve, do your best to follow God, but then they would also condemn slavery. You also have the fact that like Christians were some of the first people to ever get rid of slavery.
Well, and the weird thing about slavery is we can say, well, slavery is bad, but paying your taxes is your duty. It's the same thing. It's just more direct. Yeah.
It is interesting, like, to this day, if you're in England and the council decides that they don't like the way you work or that they don't like the changes you made to your house, they can just take your house, take away your ability to live, force you to live in a flat somewhere, and take, you know, either a government stipend or work at a job, and if you don't do that, they'll throw you in jail.
Yeah.
It's not the same as being beat to death on a plantation in the South by any means, but it's still a form of slavery.
Yeah.
It can't be compared to chattel slavery where you're just, you know, being beat to death or fought for fun.
If you look at just the statistics, the American South was nothing compared to Brazil or Haiti or any of those places.
Oh, for sure. And not only that, the treatment of slaves, while horrific, is also better in areas where they're buying them for agriculture versus taking them out of war zones and using them to build encampments and things. I mean, if you look at the way Roman slaves were treated, it is like insane.
Yeah.
Because you had these people that were pushed into slavery out of being conquered, or Greek slaves that were pushed, you know, into... I watched one thing on, I think it was a water wheel, and they had humans that would have to be in these like hot, wet conditions, and there were mines and stuff, and they were just like, oh yeah, the slaves only last, you know, a couple months to a year before they're just dead. And that was worked in. That was basically, they were saying they think it was basically just worked into the business proposition of running these things. It was, oh yeah, it's going to take this and this human life. It's okay.
Well, that's kind of how we build skyscrapers today. But
yeah, yeah. There are jobs like underwater welding and things, although those are very well paid voluntary jobs.
Yeah, it's not slavery. But
but that is still exists in the Middle East. I mean, that was one of the big things that they talked about in the World Cup, is that people will come over from mostly Southern European or Southern South Asian countries looking for work because they're in a really bad financial way, and they're treated like third-class citizens, kept from going home, and put into these jobs that have these huge mortality rates, kind of non-consensually. I think they just are a lot of times put in these jobs non-consensually, and so I guess the argument against the World Cup being held, this current, which I forget where it was held, was that they used slavery to build a stadium.
Huh.
So it's by no means gone away.
Yeah. It makes me think of when Japan held the Olympics. It's kind of off topic, but when they held the Olympics, the Catholic bishops over there said all the foreigners aren't allowed to come to Mass because they might have COVID.
So you just can't. That's so wild.
Yeah, and
I guess if you've been banned from going to Mass and you do your best to fulfill your Sunday duty, I guess you're not in a state of mortal sin. But it seems that somebody might be for restricting your access to be able to. I'm not a priest or bishop, and they have authority over me, so it's hard for me to say. But
yeah,
that is a very strange situation to find yourself in.
Yeah, well, I guess you don't have to go watch the Olympics. That's
true.
That's another, like, if to fit in society, you have to sacrifice your religion, leave your society.
Yeah, it's a hard thing to do, especially, like, go back to this. I think the herd mentality pulls so many people into it, because... And there is something to being born into a sinful culture. A lot of those people that were in Sodom and Gomorrah, if they were born into a very good culture, I think would have been influenced the opposite direction.
Yeah.
And so you swatch the snowball effect, where now you have this town where God can't find 10 good people to not destroy it, and now we think that a giant wind fart destroyed it so that we can continue in our horrible ways.
Yeah, flying the rainbow as our symbol of God's not going to destroy us.
Yeah. I remember somebody, I just remember somebody talking, like, wondering whether that was done as a taunt to God, or as a, like, hey, you promised, or if it was a little bit of both.
Yeah, well, Father Chad Ripperger, I remember an episode I watched recently where he addressed that. And so if you don't know who he is, he's an exorcist in Colorado, and he gives out a lot of conferences, kind of, and talks about a lot of similar things that we talk about, but he's a priest and actually has authority and we don't, so
yeah,
go check him
highly
out.
Highly recommend him. He puts out a lot of content. He's on YouTube, he has his own website, and the amount of good teaching that you can get out of those videos is astronomical.
Yeah.
To have the access to that is such a blessing.
Yeah,
it's one of the good parts of the internet.
I remember looking him up just on Google, and there's like people making up fake arguments against him in regard to I guess something he said about the Pope. He was like saying if the Pope were a heretic, then he couldn't be a Pope anymore, and maybe quoted Saint Robert Bellarmine. And then this guy proceeds to misquote St. Robert Bellarmine again, saying that it was just, it's a mess. That, I don't think he has anything against the Pope. Like, actually, in fact, in one of his conferences that I recently watched, he said, I am amazed how Catholics can be so cold-hearted to the Pope, because he's in charge of the whole world. You float with him or sink with him, and
yeah,
you're just gonna be like, well, not my president to the Pope. You can't do that. That's not how this country, this religion works.
I think he also has a strong personality, so he tends to pull people who are either complete naysayers and want to destroy him from the start, or complete followers who expect him to be perfect and are completely destroyed if he misspeaks in the tiniest way.
Yeah.
And both of those types will then go on the internet and start trying to destroy him. And you can't look at a priest and go, oh, he is going to, all his teaching is perfect, everything he ever says is good. But what I can say,
actually,
is that
this reminds me of St. Thomas Aquinas, because in his Summa Theologica, which is like one of the greatest works of Catholic philosophy and theology, he talks about how babies start off being plants and then they become animals.
Yeah.
And his people that want to go criticize Father Chad Ripperger, they're like, well, a doctor of the church said such and such, and like a doctor of the church also said that people start off as plants and then become animals. So people can err.
I love when people start trying to pull out stuff, because no one quotes the doctors of the church and the saints more than Father Chad. Like, we talked before, he seems to really like statistics.
Yeah.
And I guess that appeals to me, because he seems to try to back everything he says and have, like, where he comes from. Sometimes you have to look up what he's saying to figure out, like, what he's quoting. He'll say, Mary said this here, or this was said by a church father, and you'll have to figure out which church father.
It can especially be tricky when he paraphrases.
Yes, yes. But in general, it is pretty easy to find what he's quoting. And it's, in my experience, I've never found anything where he was off, at least far enough to matter.
Yeah. Well, and I wish there were more priests out there that actually backed what they said by church teaching. Because I had a priest the other day. I asked him a question, and he told me I was wrong and didn't tell me anything more. And I was just like, well, why is that? And he's like, I guess there was this misunderstanding, but if he could have just explained it to me with some reference to somewhere, then I would have figured it out. And instead,
yeah,
I was just left kind of hanging and just, I don't know.
I guess I've stopped expecting priests to have great knowledge of
the church history and of really even church teaching, because
that's
how
much
can
job, though.
It is their job, but how much can you expect when you look at the state of not only religious education for young people, but also our seminaries today, and then you're supposed to come churned out of there and be able to answer all the questions and do the right things when, okay, and in a lot of senses, we're not even studying the doctors of the church, we're studying Greek philosophy, and we're being pushed, you have to go get some sort of college degree, which all isn't always, like, have anything to do with the church.
Yeah.
And you also have some of the holiest priests were very badly educated that I've met. I met some really good priests from India who were, like, sleeping in their car because they had, like, a homeless guy sleeping in their bed, and they're doing their best to live out the fullness of Christ, but didn't have a lot of actual knowledge of the church other than just, like, hey, I know the Ten Commandments, I know to say my rosary, I know how to say Mass.
Yeah, and, well, that...
And they were, like, and I think that changed my perspective on what I expected of, like, priests. Secure, like, you talk about St. John Vianney, couldn't remember Latin, and yet he's one of the greatest saints for confession and for bringing people back to the church.
Well, on the same hand, John Vianney almost scored a perfect score in his theology, so...
That is true, that is true. But I'm just saying that, like, it has helped my mental well-being and my faith to not expect perfection from priests.
Yeah.
But I also expect them not to actively try to go against the church. There's a difference if your priest in your home parish is doing something that he knows is against church teaching, that when corrected he's not willing to change, and that he's actively pushing for, which we see especially in these priests that were molesting children or pushing through like these dance masses or all these other things. Or
I find
we talk
most
about when
common
they,
where priests will just kind of tell you what they think you want to hear. And,
that's true.
And tailor their answer to who they're talking to.
Well, I've literally heard a priest say before that, like, oh, I can't put that in the sermon because people will get upset. And I was like, well, that might be a good thing sometimes. And I think that that's happened. You'll even see a little bit of push down from the bishops to not be too... to be too inflammatory, and I think that might be to try to quell like a priest from who is wrong being inflammatory and pushing out stuff because that's his personal belief, and maybe that trying to push down that was a way of keeping like trying to keep flare-ups down, but in the end by doing that you stop the priests who can really make a huge difference from doing so as well.
Yeah.
And really, if all the priests were going out there and preaching the whole truth as they saw it, you would just see the ones that were in error and you could correct them, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
But I don't have authority in that realm.
No, I think that a lot of these things are answered in the catechism, though. So if it's in the catechism, you can trust it.
Yes, yeah. And it's very worth, refer people back to the website. Martin did an awesome job of putting up not only just one catechism you can scroll through, but a bunch of cross-references. So if you're looking at something and you're thinking, I know a couple people who like look for loopholes, don't do that. Try to find how to follow church teaching to the best extent that you can. If there's something that you think might be sinful, it probably is. Unless you're proven directly wrong, it probably is. And if you think that you may not be following church teaching in a certain area, look at the catechism. It is the greatest resource that we have. And not only can you look at one, you can look at all the catechisms that we've got on our website or that you can get your hands on and compare, cross-study. Make sure that in these areas you're actually following church teaching because it is a beautiful thing that we have this this teaching and this
And don't trust that your Sunday school taught you it, because there's a lot of things they taught me in Sunday school that I found out later aren't what the church teaches.
And that's the amazing thing about the catechism, is that it is not going to the Bible and trying to translate it for yourself. It is, in most of catechism, question and answer format. Question, direct answer. It's not, I'm going to interpret this however I want. It is, I have a question, what is the answer to it? The catechism is a beautiful thing.
Yeah, I was just thinking, like, Protestants, their only form of truth is just going to the Bible and interpreting it like it's some poem. And you got all the tradition of the church interpreting all this stuff for you, that you can find the truth, and you don't have to be just reading things that you don't understand.
Yeah. It's spelled out. Sometimes we don't. We can't understand everything. We are flawed humans. So to think that I'm going to understand the entire Bible and follow it good enough to get myself into heaven is such a self-absorbed idea, I guess.
Yeah. Like, well, for everything in the Bible, there's probably something you can find somewhere else saying something that you could interpret differently.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a vague statement, but you can pull out a passage and be like, what's this passage mean? And somebody else can pull out, well, there was a talking donkey once, so that probably means God wants you not to kill animals.
Well, and I think that what is really like a blessing for us is that as it seems that the world gets worse, and as it seems that like everything, like vices and everything grow and have more power, we also have more access to the church teaching, to our saints, to our church, to Holy Father's works, than ever before in history. If you're lost and you're swirling and you're looking for guidance, you can find so many different revisions of the catechism to cross-reference and give you a good idea of where you should be going and what you should be doing, even if you're confused. You know, even if you're confused on a subject and don't know why, you can still know what you're supposed to do. And maybe you'll find out later, maybe you'll find out in heaven.
Yeah.
And I think that's just an amazing, amazing thing that we have that.
Yeah. I guess I just feel like I can't ignore that you're going to find people who say they're Catholic and maybe are in some sort of authority that are contradicting the catechism. And you can't do that. Like,
you can't.
You're not going to have this relative truth of, well, the church is changing her opinion because the times are different. Because I hear that all the time. With like, oh, well, the God of the Old Testament was angry and mean, and the God of the New Testament is because the times changed, and now the times are changing again, so it's okay to be whatever.
I think it's really interesting. The second that you frame it in the fact that before God was he was in the role of a creator created, and after Jesus died on the cross, that he became a father-child relationship. The whole thing makes sense. The whole difference in the seeming, like, way God deals with us completely just molds into, oh, that makes perfect sense in the seeming difference between God's relationship with pre-Christ man and Christ, you know, after Christ's death.
And a lot of people will take the New Testament and just use it as an excuse to sin because God doesn't punish people in the New Testament the same way he did in the Old Testament. And St. Paul says, where sin abounds, grace abounds all the more. And then he's like, well, should I sin so that I get more grace? But that's insanity. But there's people out there just being like, well, God pardoned the adulteress, therefore I'm gonna pardon myself and go do some more adultery or hang out with adulteresses. Or you can't just say, well, I want to love people like Jesus, so I'm gonna hang out with adulteresses.
One of the things that always stuck with me is like, there is, if you consistently reject God's grace, there is that last time that you'll reject God's grace and you won't have another shot. And you have these people that think, I just do this and God will forgive me later. Well, you keep doing that, and at some point,
once saved, always saved kind of presumption.
Yeah. Yeah. At some point, you're going to say no to God, and then you're going to die.
Yeah.
and that is not going to be a good or fun eternity.
Yeah, Jean Vianney talks about the death of Voltaire, who is really influential in, like, the American Revolution and kind of the way our country's even run. And Voltaire was an outspoken critic of the church, and he lived his whole life that way. And on his deathbed, Jean Vianney says he wanted to find a priest, but his supporters wouldn't let him because he would make a shame of himself on his deathbed. And so they prevented him from seeing a priest, so he died without one.
I pray that he had a true enough contrition that he made it to heaven, but we also can't know that. Yeah. As if he'd had...
Like maybe it was just his idea that he was just going to cop out at the end and I'll just repent of everything at the end. Well, if you think you can repent of everything at the end's going to come before you know it.
Well, and how many people don't know they're going to die? I this is really off top, but like water polo is an interesting sport to me. Just the fact that it's basically two groups of people that are like professional at drowning each other. And so I always wondered, like, do people die? And I was looking up to, like, a 14-year-old kid drown playing water polo maybe a year or two ago. I'm like, that kid didn't go there thinking he was going to die that day. Yeah. That kid didn't go there thinking, hey, I better get right with God. And you live your life thinking, oh, well, I hope I make it to confession next week. I hope, you know. Yeah. If we truly believe in God and truly believe in the power of him, memento mori, you know, time is short, remember death, it's like, okay, well, I'm going to confession 10 states over because I need to get there now.
Yeah.
Like, there really should be a fervor in our belief, in our love for God and our wanting to be in his grace.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a real sad thing when priests will just, like, well, they got to say mass or whatever, so they leave the confessional and there's... six more people.
Yeah.
How do you know that? I mean, that guy ain't just gonna go die when he walks out the door. Or,
well, I mean, one of the big tells of saintly priests is you'll find they just spent tons of time in the confessional. Generally,
yeah. I knew a bishop who he'll tell a story about how he had heard this guy's confession, and he was right at the end where the guy would go, and he just died. And the bishop was just like, you fall asleep, you okay there? And he wasn't okay there. He was dead. So
imagine if the bishop had been like, I got brunch.
Yeah. Yeah.
But, yeah, it's such a hard... I mean, there is a lot... There are priests that are under a lot, and there are priests that have a hard time getting in the confessional. But it should be pushed more. Confession is such a great sacrament.
Yeah, I can't say that we should go back in time
and force us all to have confession in public, and I would hate that a lot. But it'd still be better than no confession.
Yeah.
It'd still be better than receiving without... Was it you that told me or someone else that told me that the punishment for adultery used to be like... Or the... I forget what it was.
Telling you. St. Basil talks about how... It was kind of like excommunicatable offenses. So if you had murdered somebody, you weren't allowed to come back to communion for a few years. And to us and our new way of thinking, we're like, a few years of not going to communion because you murdered somebody? Well, you murdered somebody, so...
Yeah. I don't know which is right there, because on one hand, if somebody is truly penitent and they're trying to get back in God's grace, you want them to have access to God's grace. I think that was it Pius X that brought... Who was it? No. Who is the Pope that brought, like, communion to children? Because before...
I think it was Pius X. He lowered it... I don't know if he lowered it to 7 or if he lowered it from...
I just know that, like, there was a lot of... There have been times in history where we've gone the other way, where people would only receive once a year. They weren't getting the graces from communion that are valid to get, and they were just sitting around.
Yeah.
I think you can have look at error in the past that wasn't the best idea either.
No, but it's still... I guess if the church says that's how it's going to be, who are you to argue with them?
Nobody.
Yeah.
Nobody at all.
So,
I'm a guy who's trying to be on a podcast for people to listen to while they're at work because there's nothing much else to listen to.
Yeah, you're going to go up to the bishop and say, yeah, I know I killed somebody, but I demand the Son of God now.
Oh, yeah, because you have to listen to authority in those situations, unless they are asking you to do something wrong. If he's like, you killed somebody, so now you got to rape somebody. Like, if that was what they said. Or if your bishop is an Arian... You know, as a heretic, then,
that's what St. Basil said, is that there was a certain diocese where the bishop became an Arian, and he said the best people in that diocese would just, every Sunday, would go out into the desert and mourn and pray, because they couldn't go to church anymore because it was heresy.
He was the one that wrote about them surrounding the church so that he couldn't get back in.
St. Basil?
I'm probably wrong. I remember reading someone writing that their bishop or their priest had become an Arian heretic, and so the people just, like, surrounded the church and wouldn't ever let him back in the church.
Oh, I don't actually remember that story.
I'll have to fact check it, but it is something that I'm pretty sure I heard at Mass somebody talking about it. So there is this. I always try to remember I like everything in moderation. So when you look at a priest, you're like, you don't expect him to be perfect, but you should also make sure that your priest isn't like actively leading you into error. When you look at like. So that
be able to expect your priest not to be a pedophile.
Yes, you should be obedient, but you should also not be obedient into sinfulness. It's just like obedience to your parents. They are your elders. It's just one step up. You know, it's not to the priest level, but they're your elders. They have that right over you. But the second that they start pushing you into something that's sinful or against God, that obedience is no longer...
Well, obedience to God first.
Yeah, exactly. But it is easy. I think it's very easy to get sucked into... like a cult of personality, even around some traditional priests, where they're like, well, whatever he says is right, even if he's wrong.
Yeah.
And that is a dangerous place to be. Or on the opposite end, where you become full-blown Protestant and you leave the church completely because you know better than everybody else all the time.
Yeah, that's a good point. Like, if you can't find anybody in the Catholic Church backing your belief, if the Catechism explicitly says you're wrong, you're wrong. So,
yeah, there is, and that's the great thing about the Catechism. You can go back and make sure if somebody hands you something and says this is a Catechism and it contradicts a previous Catechism, it's wrong. You have all these catechisms that all can agree with each other, that don't contradict each other, that you can go back and check. And not only is it Not only you're able to look at it as something, you can objectively say it as yes and no, right or wrong answers. It's such a great thing to be able to keep yourself to be obedient, but also to know these are the teachings of the church. Whether I understand them or not, these are what we have to follow.
Yeah, I think that's part of why the Orthodox have so many issues is because they haven't taught anything since the 1400s. Because they don't believe they can teach without Rome, because they can't teach without Rome, and so
I know a lot of Orthodox that would greatly disagree with that last statement you said.
Well, then ask them what their stance is on contraception, because they haven't taught anything.
Yeah,
there is no official teaching from the Orthodox on contraception.
Well, not only that, there's several Orthodox churches that allow divorce. There's no unity within them either. There's unity in maybe disliking Catholics or maybe we all love Mary, and I can find that pretty commonly across the Orthodox, but there is a lot of disunity on like, hey, is abortion cool? Okay. We pretty much all agree that it's not, but some people will allow you to use the morning after pill. Some of them, and those are usually the crazy sects, some of them allow contraception that's like, okay, you can wear a condom. Some of them allow divorce, some don't. And so you don't see the unity of teaching that we have.
Yeah, well, that's what happens when you enter schism. You're going to have those problems.
Mm-hmm. Well, I always thought that St. Francis was the greatest example of being in kind of a bad time in church history, and just, he started an order. He taught by example. He was a huge influence on bringing the church back into a holy space. And I always looked up to him for that. And I guess they think that he's a great example.
You mean he's not just a hippie who, like, played with bugs and stuff?
And aminals.
Aminals.
He liked aminals. It is really interesting to me how many people... I smile whenever I see it. How many non-Catholics have a statue of St. Francis in their garden. And I'm like, you know, you may have it for the wrong reasons, but I'm really happy it's here. In a way, it's like, this is really, you know, they could be out there worshiping a demon or something, but it's just some, like, random atheist person. It's like, yeah, but he liked birds, so I got it.
Yeah, he also beat himself till he bled at night for penance for God, so.
Yeah. A little more hardcore.
Yeah.
I think the church is kind of against self-mutilation at this point.
Well, is it mutilation if it's just a little bit of blood?
I don't know. I feel like harming your body in any way. And I also think that you can... There is a bit of...
Well, but in the past, they also did things like bloodletting, where they thought bleeding was healthy. So.
But you can do things that aren't actually bad for your body that are horrific, and oftentimes less... Like, there is a certain sense of what am I trying to say? Like, masochism? Is that the right word? Or sadist? Like, but, like, where you're beating yourself and you're getting, like, a little bit something out of it because it feels like you're doing something.
Yeah.
Whereas there is types of, like fasting in moderation where you're not hurting your body, but you are entering discomfort, forcing yourself to do acts that you don't want to do at all, putting yourself into things. Like, you can put yourself into cold water and put yourself into even, like, a mild shock, and it's very good for your body, and you don't want to do it, and if you can offer it up to God. You know, these things that are helpful, they're good for your body, but also horribly uncomfortable that could be offered to God versus mutilating your temple, which is probably not a great idea now that we know better.
They say Ivan the Terrible had a hair shirt that was just horribly uncomfortable.
See, in a hair shirt, I mean, unless it's causing you to develop emphysema and then affecting your wife, you know, or emphysema, eczema, sorry, or something like that, you know, then it wouldn't, I don't think that would be a sinful thing to do.
Well,
uncomfortable sweater.
John the Baptist wore camel's clothes, camel skin.
Yeah,
and
Well, he didn't have a wife, as far as I know, so.
Yeah.
But I have heard of people doing, like, penances that then affect their family, and I did hear a priest a couple of years ago talking like, hey, don't go do a penance that's going to, like, make your kids go hungry. Don't force something that is going to end up hurting the other people around you. That's not the point of this at all.
Yeah.
But... Is there anything else you want to talk about Sodom and Gomorrah and the archaeological find there? Anything we didn't go over? Because I feel like we talked about quite a bit, but I know that you've...
Well, I went over it all really fast, so...
Yeah, it flew by faster than I thought it was going to, but we had, you know, quite a bit that we had to talk about otherwise as well.
Yeah, I guess my biggest point here is that there are... A lot of people who like to say that, well, science has disproven the Bible or your religion, and it hasn't even gotten close to that. And if anything, science has proved it, because what are the odds that some crazy guy writing down random religious stuff would happen to be right on anything if he wasn't right on everything?
I feel that even if you have no belief in the Bible, the fact that it has a story of an event happening, and people were obviously writing this stuff down for a reason, and then we can find archaeological evidence that seems to prove that it happened, whether you believe it was a meteor or not, is excellent proof for the validity of of the Bible.
Well, and they like to say that, the Mesopotamians had something like the story of the flood. Therefore, the Jews just stole it from the Mesopotamians, who made it up from their deities. No, the Jews took it because it actually happened. The Mesopotamians actually knew that it actually happened. That's just as likely.
Yeah. Yeah, that's everybody having the same story is probably usually a great way to tell that something's real.
Yeah.
It's not just especially with the flood story, and that it doesn't feel like it's a game of telephone. It's like everybody has almost exactly the same story, which seems to reason that they have it directly from the source. Not like, oh, the Jews had a story, I thought it'd be cool to add it to mine, and we changed it up. But usually when legend is passed from culture to culture and it didn't actually happen, it changes significantly.
Yeah, well, I remember when I was younger getting kind of... It was troublesome to hear about some of these archaeological things about evolution, for example. And you're like, well, this was an ancient human that lived 3 million years ago. How do you know that? And they're like, well, we found a bone, and it looks like it walked upright, so therefore, it must have been a human.
Well, I swing back and forth on that. I'm of the belief that even if we completely prove evolution, that does nothing to disprove God. But on the other hand, I think that the current I think that we can show adaptation, but I also don't think that we can show complete evolution of humanity.
Well, and evolution I don't think makes sense for the reason that they say evolution is through natural selection, so the best traits survive. Well, don't you think somewhere between being, say, a dolphin and an elephant, there would be something that just is horribly unfit for survival? But they're like, well, it's all these gradual steps to being closer to surviving, but you can't get from one extreme to the other without being an intermediate that just doesn't work.
Yeah. Well, I guess their argument would be there was a bunch of intermediates and some of them worked and reproduced and the rest died.
You have to have an intermediate that's better than all the other things of that day. So,
right.
And they have some fossils of, like, fish that might have had legs that could walk a little bit. And I think that's cool. Okay, but it doesn't really get you anything very great. It's all these really tiny minor changes. Like, okay, there were some birds that developed different beaks for eating different food. Hurrah. Now make that bird a different animal. Make it a spider.
It's also interesting to show that, like, they started out with Neanderthals. When we were kids, they were like, yeah, they were cavemen that grunted each other. And even now, they're like, okay, they had art, they had music. We know they had art, they had music, they had language. That a lot of Europeans have Neanderthal DNA in them.
They were better at harvesting birch sap or beech sap than we are. So.
Their estimated IQ is higher than some people living today. And you're like, oh, so you just found another race of people that got assimilated.
But we had to pretend they're a different species because we're extra racist.
So yeah, but a lot of our theories are built on false science that has been disproven, and so we know so little. They'll find another, like, oh, we found this Lucy that, like, I think Lucy.
Yeah.
Like, okay, well, that one's cool, but it's basically just a chimpanzee.
Yeah.
And we have three skull bones or whatever. I'm spitballing here, but like we'll have like three. Well, like so many of our dinosaurs of today came from like three bones, and then they would just make this huge thing. And now we're going back through and auditing where our idea of like why did you think this dinosaur looked like this?
Yeah, they really got rid of the brontosaurus because they decided that it was the same thing as an apontosaurus.
Yeah. And it makes sense.
They just put the bones together wrong and came up with a new dinosaur. That's literally what happened. So,
yeah. I don't fault the people who did that either. But to keep those same ideas and to make such huge outlandish claims while we're still learning is dumb. It doesn't make a lot of sense. I think that we have a religious tradition that in almost all senses leads us in a very good direction. I believe in all senses does, and I think that until there's some crazy thing that pushes me to disbelieve some part of it that completely proves it, I see no reason to even try to argue. And I think that science in general hasn't gone and gone
against. It's really interesting how they went from the Big Bang proves that the universe just spontaneously existed from one moment when God said, "Let it exist." Oh wait. This was supposed to be atheist, huh? We're going to have to rethink that.
Yeah. Well, and now you see, like, okay, where did the Big Bang come from? And they're like, well, maybe there's infinite parallel universes, and they siphon energy off each other. And so then you're like, okay, well, if there's infinite parallel universes and they siphon energy off each other, that means that they're... Is it? And they'll be like, oh, it's like a continuous loop, and that's how it feeds back. And as energy bleeds off of one universe, it goes into the next universe. I was like, so there is some sort of consistent and all, like, forever lasting energy source that just keeps things alive? Or is it easier to say that there's just in eternity that there's a being who is forever and always and unchanging that was able to create us? That makes way more sense than any other argument that we can come up with.
And I think a lot of people just don't even sit back and just think that when we say God always was, he always was. Like, there was an eternity before he even made us. I can't wrap my head around that, but...
It's really interesting that humans really, because we are beings of matter, we cannot imagine nothing, and we cannot imagine eternity.
Yeah.
It's just impossible. Our brains are not... I imagine the angels can, But maybe they even they can't, because maybe they can't imagine a world without... This is, I have no idea. But maybe they can't imagine a world without thought, without being, you know?
Yeah, I don't know. That's another thing is, like, we... How can anybody deny that they're conscious, they have a consciousness? Like Descartes said, I think, therefore I am, which he got condemned because he tried to prove everything from his own, like, mind. But he has some truth in that.
They're just robots. That they're just biological robots, and that really every thought they had was pre-programmed.
Well, they've been smoking too much something. And I think that's what happens.
It's like Calvinism put together with...
Yeah, I think that's what happens when... I don't know if it's depression or if it's these happy pills that people are taking, is that they can lose sense of reality, but you know that you're alive, you know that you're doing what you're doing, so, and you know no scientific chemical reaction could make you. There's none that we could ever have possibly seen.
A big part of science also is questioning, and I think that because religion is the established norm for all of human history that we can remember, people who naturally question things and try to prove things wrong or to prove things correct are going to want to, and especially a lot of people who are involved in these things have some degree of self-worth wrapped up in their ability to prove something wrong or prove something right or make a new discovery. So they're going to go for the biggest thing they can find, which is Christianity, which is God, and trying to question these things and disprove them. It's just, I feel like, a natural thing that's going to happen when you have a field that's dedicated in the way we've structured science.
Yeah, even though a lot of science has to credit the Catholics for promoting it. So.
Yeah. We have to think that there was a time that, like, the known writing civilized world was mostly all Christian. And not all of us were writing, but there was a huge sect of the people that were sitting in monasteries copying things down, especially for our culture, was just Christians.
Yeah. Yeah, my brother told me that they think Gregor Mendel, who came up with the theories of genetics that we still use today, fudged his numbers because they can't get them to work out.
Really?
Yeah. I don't know whether he did or didn't, but it's...
Do you think he was just, like, making a leap to try to make... Be able to, like, okay, well, here's
where... Well, he might have just had too small of a sample set to like, have enough statistical certainty, so then he made it come to what he thought it should be.
Huh. That's interesting. I find myself engrossed in history and in... I guess church teaching often, but I don't often push myself into, like, minute details of the sciences, and I wish I did more often.
Yeah.
I said often, like, 15 times there. I apologize to anybody who had to listen to that. But, yeah, thank you for bringing that up. I have not researched a lot into... Like I was talking before, I like ancient civilizations and looking into it. And like I was talking about Göbekli Tepe. I've been watching some stuff on that and reading a few books and different people who have ideas on older civilizations and our ideas of... I find that really interesting. And so when somebody brings up something like, hey, we found Sodom and Gomorrah, that really... I find that awesome that people are actually looking into that and making those conclusions.
Yeah. Yeah, it's sad that things like that aren't taken more seriously, because it has a bigger impact than what the attention it's getting. But
yeah, I think also it is good for Catholics to get back involved in these things, for us to regain our... there's a lot of people like we don't care much anymore. But
it's kind of like when we figured out that the sun, that it made more mathematical sense for the Earth to rotate the sun, that we just kind of gave up. Mm-hmm. And we're like, well, we're not going to try and find out if science proves God anymore.
Yeah. I don't know.
But for all
I
those think... people that say the sun is the center of the solar system, there is no center in relative motion. So get your head out of your scientific...
Bum.
Yeah, relative motion. There's no center. The Earth could be the center of the universe, but it'd make the math a lot more complicated, so we don't model it that way.
It's always been, I don't know, I completely lost my train of thought there. Where was I going with this? Oh, I was going to say, it also seems that we've given up on a lot of things that made the church great, like our push for beauty. Yeah. I'm sure we'll have a podcast on this at some point, but they used to say, like, hey, it is a great thing to go for beauty. It feeds the soul. And now you go into whitewashed churches that have no...
Yeah, they always wanted you to walk into the church to be amazed because it's God's house.
And another thing, we do believe in faith and reason. And so we can't just neglect reason as Catholics. Yeah. And that's something that a lot of us have neglected, and a lot of us haven't put the work into. Like, hey, we are supposed to be out here. God gave us a beautiful universe to go and try to understand and to know him better. And doing our best to know him through the lens of our faith and through the lens of what we can prove is a very good calling.